And welcome everyone to yet another very, very special episode of Podcasting Them Softly. This is Nick, and of course I'm joined by Frank. What's going on, buddy?
Not much, man. This is going to be fantastical.
Yeah, and I know I'm speaking for the both of us when I say how truly lucky we are tonight. Joining us for a chat is veteran film editor Mark Goldblatt. Mark's credits are essentially a roll call of some of the greatest action-adventure films of our lifetimes. The Terminator, Terminator 2, True Lies, Bad Boys 2, Pearl Harbor, Armageddon, Commando, Rambo First Blood Part 2, Starship Troopers, Predator 2, and of course, Tony Scott's immortal action masterpiece, The Last Boy Scout. I can't believe I just read all those credits. My mind is blown. He's worked with some of the absolute titans of industry, including James Cameron, Michael Bay, Paul Verhoeven, Joe Dante, all of whom he's worked with more than once, multiple times. Some of his other amazing credits include Rise of the Planet of the Apes, Hollow Man, Showgirls, multiple collaborations with Canon Films, head honcho Menahem Golan. Mark's directorial debut was The Wild and Crazy Dead Heat with Treat Williams and Joe Piscopo, which he followed up with the absolutely awesome The Punisher with Dolph Lundgren, beating the superhero trend by many years. Can't wait to talk to him about this. I can still remember the physical location of that VHS on the Blockbuster shelf. That's how many times I rented that movie. Honestly, we're overwhelmed by your resume, Mark, and we can't wait to get into all of it. Thank you so very much for agreeing to chat with us, and we're just so pumped to discuss your work.
Well, guys, I'm really happy to be here. Through the magic of the internet and Skype, we can have this meeting without actually having to cross the country to do it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. It makes it very convenient for us.
Very cool. So I'm at your disposal, basically. You want to put me in any given direction, we'll see where it takes us.
All right, I promise before we get into everything that Nick and I are going to try and stay coherent with our direction on this podcast. I'm going to lead this off. I echo everything Nick said. Thank you very much for taking the time.
My pleasure.
Nick and I became obsessed with this movie a couple weeks ago before we even saw it. And
it
the
really
film is the
poster. It was the poster that started it off. We were just like, oh.
The film was on my on-demand. It's The Ambassador with Robert Mitchum and Rock Hudson and Ellen Burstyn. I'd never heard of it before. I messaged Nick about it. He flipped out when he started reading up about it. And then Nick and I both watched it a few times over the past couple weeks. Now, I don't even know where to begin with this film.
Well, see, we can begin at the beginning.
Okay.
I mean, the thing about the movie is that it's got a terrific cast.
Yes.
And it's directed by the great J. Lee Thompson.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Done a ton of great movies. Everyone knows The Guns of Navarone, but he's a terrific craftsman.
The White Buffalo.
I was very fortunate to work on this picture. what had happened was, I was supposed to be doing The Terminator at that point in time, but Arnold Schwarzenegger had had a pre-existing deal with Dino De Laurentiis to do a picture of Dino's choosing within a certain time frame. Dino called in his chips on that, and I think it was Red Sonja that Arnold had to do. So that basically put Terminator on hold, and we had to wait until Arnold was done before we could do Terminator. Now, that meant I was available, and Menachem actually called me. Menachem kind of pushed me onto J. Lee Thompson. He convinced J. Lee Thompson that I was the right guy to do his movie. And Lee went ahead and said, okay, but he was really kind of pissed off. He felt he was being pressured. And he thought that I was going to be a company spy, which is not unlikely when the head of the studio, in this case Canon Pictures, is saying, take my editor. So I think that it means that it's a way that they have of getting intelligence back in the power suites from the editor. But that wasn't the case. First of all, I had been a big fan of Lee, so I went and saw him and said, listen, I want you to know I'm a really big fan. I love this picture, that picture, Return from the Ashes, I mentioned. Some pictures that that were more dear to him than his most popular pictures. So he agreed to give me a chance, and he was going off to Israel to shoot this movie. The movie was based very loosely on a property that Canon Films had called 52 Pickup, which they later remade as a contemporary picture that took place in the United States. But they did the same basic plot is in both pictures, which is about this black male. I don't want to give too much of it away in case anyone guessed it. It's available on Warner Archive. And I guess it's also on a German Blu-ray. Is that right?
Yeah, that's what I grabbed. I didn't know that it was on Warner. I didn't realize it was on Warner Archives. But yes, I did grab the German Blu-ray. It was like $8. You know, I don't know how I got the deal, but I did. And it looks great. This is all fascinating. And you to sort of, you know, preface this, you had done some films for Canon Films before The Ambassador.
Yes, I came in on Over the Brooklyn Bridge, which was a film that Martin Golan had actually directed. No, wait a second. I came in on Enter the Ninja. That was my first picture. And because I had kind of known one of their production people, a guy named John Thompson, who's still producing pictures now, works a lot with Avi Lerner at New Image. And I had done The Howling, but it hadn't come out yet. And John was friends of friends. He had heard really good things about The Howling. I showed him a little bit of it. So when they had some issues on Enter the Ninja, if you know the story of Enter the Ninja, they made this ninja movie in the Philippines. And trying to remember, the stunt coordinator was actually starring in the picture as the ninja. I guess his name was Mike Stone. And he wasn't really cutting the mustard for Menachem's taste. He was just not, you know, he wasn't delivering the kind of movie they wanted. So Menachem flew to the Philippines and decided he was going to take the picture over as a director. Very convenient when the head of the company is a director, he can just come and direct it himself. And then he doesn't have to worry about satisfying himself so much because he knows what he likes. And that's what they did. But he also felt that Mike Stone was not a very charismatic leading man, even with the ninja suit on. So his brilliant stroke was that Mike Stone would continue to play the ninja, the white ninja, mind you, the good ninja, against Shul Kasugi, who was the bad ninja, but only when he was dressed in his ninja clothes with his mask on. In other words, he became his own stunt double. But now Menachem needed to get a lead for this picture, and he happened to be having dinner in the hotel dining room, and he saw Franco Nero eating dinner there. Franco, I guess, had been doing a picture in Manila. So he immediately offered Franco Nero the role in the Enter the Ninja movie. He signed the deal on a napkin. This is one of the legendary Canon stories. So he now had a go picture, he had a star, and he was directing. So anyway, that's where I came in. I was hired to try to make editorial sense out of the footage that had already been shot and make it better. Now, in these days, I had just come off of The Howling. So if you look in my resume, or you'll, I don't know if you have one handy, that may help.
Yes, I do.
It'll help just structure things, because I get mixed up as to what came first.
Yeah, it looks like 1981 was a big year. Halloween 2, The Howling, and Enter the Ninja, which is just like, I mean, it's like, I just can't fathom it. But
you have to understand, in those days, working on the independent pictures and exploitation pictures, we didn't have a hell of a lot of time. They would shoot the movie quickly. They might shoot it in 4 weeks. We might cut it in 6 weeks, 8 weeks. I mean, I'd have to get a cut ready to show pretty much as soon as they wrap. And then you wouldn't have a lot of time left to finish it. We used to mix in 3 days or less. So it was very, it was really very much a crash course in filmmaking. And when I say crash, I really mean it. We were racing against the clock to get it done.
So really, honestly, I think a good question to ask you would be Piranha. I mean, that's your first, on the IMDb, that is your first feature credit as an editor. Joe Dante directed Piranha, 1978. What was it like making that movie? Because, you know, it's been remade, it's been riffed on, and, you know, it itself was a riff on Jaws. And what can you tell us about your first film that you worked on?
Well, I was very lucky to work on it. And the reason I worked on it was because I have to go back in time now and then give you my story if you want it.
Absolutely.
I got back into the editing room, meaning back in is where I wanted to be in the first place. But you don't just walk into an editing job, really. So I had graduated from the London Film School in 1974. And I found when I was going to film school that having tried out most of the technical jobs, you know, that outside of directing, I loved editing. And I really did love it and do love it. And I had a knack for it. I had a great editing teacher at the film school named Frank Clark, who had, among his many credits, was editing Blow Up for Antonioni. And he was a contract editor at MGM. But MGM Film Studios shut down in the 70s, early 70s, and a lot of guys like Frank went into teaching. He was, you know, getting older anyway, so I think teaching was a natural fit for him. And he was a great teacher. So I learned how to edit from him. So anyway, I showed up in 1974. I graduated from film school, showed up in Hollywood. Here I am with my diploma and my diploma film. Hire me. Not so easy. After slumming around a while, trying to getting some jobs in educational filmmaking and things like that, I actually saw a screening of Death Race 2000. It was playing on a triple bill at the World Theater on Hollywood Boulevard. I had always been a Roger Corman fan. I wasn't really familiar with New World Pictures. That was his company. This was a New World Pictures on a triple bill. I can't tell you what else was on it. I loved it. Death Race 2000, shot in probably 4 weeks, directed by Paul Bartel. Fantastic movie. Tina Hirsch was the editor. This movie just had real energy to it, real life. I don't know if you remember it. But
absolutely.
Yeah, it was great fun. And I said to myself, I need to be working on movies like this. I'm going into Roger Corman's office and get a job. So I did. And I walked into the office of New World Pictures one day and asked the receptionist, who do I talk to about getting a job editing? And she said, I don't know. Oh, I'll talk to that guy over there. This guy was crossing the hall. His name was John Davison. John Davison was the head of advertising at New World. He was about to produce his first movie called Hollywood Boulevard to be directed by Joe Dante and Alan Arkush, two editors, no waiting. I'm sorry, two editor-directors, actually, because they were both out of the editing room. They used to cut the trailers. They were the two-thirds of the trailer department at New World Pictures. And they were getting their directing debut, so to speak. So this was a big deal. The reason they got the film to make was that John Davison proposed to Roger that he would make a bet that he could direct, that he could produce a movie for $100,000, shoot it in 4 weeks, or maybe it was 2 weeks. No, actually, it was 2 weeks or something. And use a lot of stock footage. They would shoot the movie around existing stock footage of car explosions, you name it. And then they would only have to shoot new shots of actors in costumes that go into the cars in the car chases, things like that. So they got the deal, except Roger said, well, I won't give you what you're asking for, but I'll give you $60,000 in 10 days. Well, that's the way I remember this story. So they made this movie. They were about to make it. John said, you want to be a PA? I said, sure. No pay, but we will feed you. So I had to get up in the morning at 5 a.m., get a five-gallon jug of coffee and fill it, or actually two of them, fill it with coffee, get donuts, bring it to the set, which is usually out of L.A., about 30 miles out, so that it was still in the 30-mile limit, so you didn't have to pay for travel expenses for the cast or crew, per diems, anything like that. I'd have to go get food for them. I would feed them. I would help the art department by tearing sets down, holding on to stunt buildings that were going to collapse by piano wire. It was really weird. And, you know, a stunt passenger in some stunt scenes. I mean, I didn't know any better. But, you know, they said, all right, who'll sit in this stunt car while we're going at 60 miles an hour? I'll do it. So I did all that shit. And the movie was fun, great fun to make. We worked, you know, 18 hours or more a day. It was really fantastic. So I think at the end of the first week, I said, you got to pay me. I can't do this anymore. So John said, we'll give you $60 a week, non-retroactive. So I didn't make very much money on the movie, but at least I got a little money out of it. But what I got out of it mostly was an introduction to exploitation filmmaking, which was great. It was kamikaze filmmaking and fantastic stuff. Also, I got to work with the greatest group of people. I got to meet Joe Dante and work with him.
Yeah, I'm such a fan of Joe. I mean, I know Frank is too. Joe Dante's movies mean so much to me. I grew up watching Interspace, The Explorers. I mean, all of his stuff is just, it really is just movie magic in a way that you don't see very often these days.
Totally, totally. You know, I did work on Interspace a little bit. Ken Beta was the editor of Interspace, and I was between pictures, and Ken and Joe asked me if I would come in and help them when they had some additional footage that they needed edited as they were getting ready for a preview. So I got to work on some great footage on that movie, too. But I digress. Anyway, so Joe Dante, Alan Arkush, also great director as well, Rock and Roll High School fame, and others. So, and the thing is, we were all like super film nerd, film buff type people. You know, we loved movies. When, you know, like when I went to summer camp as a kid, other people would talk about baseball batting averages. I would talk about release dates and running times and aspect ratios. You know, so people would be coming up with arcane sports facts. I would challenge people to name a movie, any movie at all, and see if I can come up with something about it. And I usually won the bets. So, and the other thing is that not only did we all love films, but we all especially loved the outré, the edgy film, great horror films, fantasy, science fiction. You know, these were guys who loved all the same movies I loved. So it was great. We started, I mean, actually Joe and John were film collectors even back then, in those days. And they had they would always screen movies on the weekends. I was always invited. You know, someone would pick up the pizza cost, somebody would get the beer. We had a great time. So we all bonded. So as everyone kind of got heavier into the work they were doing, it was natural that we would all work together. And, you know, plus other great individuals who were part of this team were Paul Bartel, the late, great Paul Bartel, Jonathan Kaplan, who also appears in Hollywood Boulevard. I mean, most everybody has a small part in that. So anyway, so that's how I got to work with Joe. When Joe was done directing Hollywood Boulevard, which was, you know, it was released, but it wasn't heavily released, played drive-in theaters mostly, maybe 42nd Street. But it was a really well-made film. You know, it kind of became a cult classic early on. But it proved to Roger that Joe could direct a movie and that Alan could direct a movie. So they both were kept on in editing when they weren't prepping a movie to direct. The next movie that Joe was going to direct was Piranha. In the meantime, I became his assistant editor on Grand Theft Auto. And then he threw me some stuff to edit, and I became his second editor, so I was the associate editor. And then when he went to do Piranha, he actually offered me the job of co-editing the movie with him. You have to remember, he was a self-taught editor himself and a great editor. Still is, if he cares to edit. Actually, he edits the trailers from Hell website stuff that he also directs, basically.
I'm obsessed with Trailers from Hell. It's an addictive website.
Great fun. I'm going to pop a throat lozenge in my mouth here. Tell me if it gets in the way.
No problem. At all.
Great. It's a little sticky, though. I don't think I'm going to put it in there because I have a feeling it'll take a tooth out with me. Okay, we tried. So we get back to Piranha. Piranha was filmed, most of the exteriors, or a lot of the exteriors, were shot in Texas, you know, for the big lake scenes, all the water stuff. A bunch of it was shot in L.A. So I didn't get to go to Texas, but I was cutting while Joe was shooting in Texas and in the Hollywood area as well. Bronson Canyon, for example, Bronson Caves. So it was a kamikaze thing. I just jump in there and start editing. I remember asking Joe, well, Joe, you got to give me some notes. Tell me what takes you like. Tell me what you don't like. Tell me how you think you want the scene to go. And Joe's answer was, don't be crazy. All I want you to do is make the movie work. Make it work. Make the movie work. It's like, I have no plan. Yeah, I mean, he had a plan, but, you know, he's a very self-deprecating guy. And it was his first movie. I'm sure he was a little nervous, too. And anyway, it all came together. And it actually was a big, big, big success for everybody concerned. I remember when we showed the first cut to Roger Corman. This picture, by the way, was again produced by John Davison, and Joe directed solo this time. So when we showed him the film, and in those days we would get black and white dailies because, you know, color wasn't necessarily the norm, and labs still printed in black and white, and they were cheaper than color dailies. So you'd always be surprised when you finally did get color answer prints, because sometimes you'd have a car chase and you'd cut from one car to another and the car would change color because you got it another color car. You couldn't tell what color anything was. So anyway, he came out of the screening. We showed him the movie. He said, gentlemen, your futures are assured. That to Joe, John, and to me, there were just three of us there at the screening. So that was really good.
And yeah, I would say so, and I would say that comment, "Your future is assured," was certainly lived up to, because when you start to look, you know, at the '80s and the movies that you were a part of, I mean, I'm just like, I guess it didn't dawn on me that both Rambo First Blood Part 2 and Commando both came out in 1985. So my my assumption is that you were, I don't know if you were simultaneously editing those two films or if they were one on top of another. I just, those are two of the greatest, most amazing 80s action movies ever made. So, how did the Joe Dante, Roger Corman exploitation beginnings lead into, I mean, blockbuster, you know, Hollywood stuff and you know, with Stallone and all those guys?
Well, let's see. They were cyclical. One thing led to another. From Piranha, I actually got a movie called Spirit of the Wind to edit, which was a complete about-face. It was a movie about the Iditarod and a world-famous... The Iditarod is a dog sled race in Alaska, and it's a world-class dog sled race, and it's about a guy named George Atla, who was the world champion dog sledder. It's his life story and how he overcame a childhood infirmity, actually he had polio, to become the world champion. I got this because an entertainment lawyer that I knew had been working with Buffy St. Marie, who was going to do some of the music for this movie, which was actually funded by an Alaskan Indian tribe. And they needed an editor. They had shot all the footage. They had minimal amounts of money. This was a case of a friend helping me out using my previous credit to springboard me. Anyway, I met with these two young guys, Ralph Little and John Logue. Ralph was the director, John... they co-wrote it, and John was the DP. Beautiful footage, really nice story. We just worked together. They were my assistant editors, along with a guy named Bill Hooper. We worked out of their garage. They rented a house in the Pacific Palisades. They had actually been living in Alaska. And we made this movie that became the official American entry in the Cannes Film Festival's En Certain Regard category, which are kind of offbeat films. They still have that category.
Mm-hmm.
So we got to go to the Cannes Film Festival with this movie, which was only my second movie. Of course, we had to pay our own way, but because we had no money. We had secondhand tuxedos that we got from the thrift shop. But it was great. And also, we won the very first Sundance Film Festival Best Picture Award with this movie. It's a movie that nobody knows about, by the way, but you could look it up. It's a very good movie. But it's been plagued by bad distribution or lack of distribution, really.
It might be the one movie on your resume I have not seen.
Well, there, unfortunately, there's an out-of-print French DVD. I'm still waiting for them to get a deal. And this movie was made in 1979. But anyway, what it enabled me was to do was to keep editing and get my chops up, make a little money to pay the rent. And we got some prestigious notice for it. Unfortunately, as I said, it was owned by this tribal company. Somehow or other, they never were able to get the deals that they wanted to get. It appeared on Z Channel back in the 70s. Late 70s or early 80s. It was also on the Disney Channel. But now it seems to be out of distribution. So I have a copy that the director gave me. So if you guys are ever in L.A., maybe I'll run it for you.
That's a wonderful...
I certainly take you up on that.
So from that, I went to the opposite extreme again. I was offered a movie called Humanoids from the Deep, which is a Roger Corman production meant to capitalize on the water theme of Piranha, this time with humanoids, kind of like creatures from the Black Lagoon.
Crazy film.
Crazy yeah. film. And I said, sure. Now, this is a movie that Joe Dante had turned down because he thought it was not, he couldn't figure out a way to do it and not keep a straight face. And so a woman named Barbara Peters was the director. Now, this movie had problems. I don't know if you've read about some of the legendary problems that we had, but basically the movie didn't work, wasn't scary, didn't make sense, didn't have enough coverage. I had a 70-minute rough cut. So I had to show it to Roger. I explained to him as soon as I realized that there were issues and explained to him that we did have some profound issues, but that I thought it was fixable with some judicious pickups and a little bit of reshooting, which he was totally on board for. And we did it. You know, the picture went out and made a lot of money. I mean, you have to understand that in the great sea of exploitation pictures, movies like The Howling, I'm sorry, starting with movies like Piranha particularly, and to a lesser degree, Human with Nadine, but not box office-wise, it also did very well, were head and shoulders above the average movie that was coming out of exploitation filmmaking. It happened that Roger had a deal with United Artists to do the European distribution for his pictures at this point. Piranha was a part of that deal, and so was Humanoid. So they were really, you know, a lot more deep pockets available to promote these pictures in Europe. And New World came to the fore. They also showed these theater movies in legitimate theaters in the United States, meaning beyond the drive-in and the grindhouse. Because really, a lot of his movies never got beyond the grindhouses or the drive-in theaters. And that had been the chief target for a lot of these pictures. But I remember seeing Piranha in Santa Monica at the local movie theater that I used to go to when I lived in there, that area. So pictures got shown, pictures got seen, they made money and were competitive with the major studio pictures. This was huge for the independent picture. So anyway, I went from that. Joe asked me back to work on The Howling, which was now a picture for AFCO Embassy, not for Roger Corman. Mike Fennell, who had been a fellow production assistant on Hollywood Boulevard with me, was now the line producer, or actually creative producer as well. He was the producer of record and of note and of truth. Worked his ass off. And he went on to produce most of Joe's legendary big studio pictures. I think all of them, actually, give or take, until Mike retired from the business. I don't know if he's retired. I think he still works back home, but he moved back east to Connecticut. He's a property, and he's enjoying his life. Anyway, we did The Howling. And this was a bigger budget than any of us had on any pictures. I think it was $1 million. Maybe it was 1.8 million. I lose track now. But it wasn't a lot of money. It was probably more than the neighborhood of $1 million. You can check it out. And that was a huge hit. That was a big hit. You know, we had Rob Bottin creating bladder effects, revolutionary makeup effects and visual effects, a great script, great looking picture. John Sayles, of course, did the screenplay.
It's a classic. It's one of the. I was never a huge horror movie person growing up, but it's one of the few horror movies that I did watch a bunch of times when I was a kid, and it really scared the shit out of me.
That's what it was meant to do.
Right.
Yeah, the budget was $1 million, that's for sure. So John Hora shot the hell out of it. Beautiful colors. I think Joe and John collaboratively were influenced heavily by Mario Bava, just because Bava was so great in his saturated use of color. And it was true even on Hollywood Boulevard. So here again, I kept getting to work on movies that made an impression at the box office. And it made an impression critically over and above the usual spate of releases, especially in the low-budget realm. And the more successful the pictures were, the better kinds of pictures I was offered personally. So, you know, from that I got into The Ninja, which I told you about. And I came in on Halloween 2 because they wanted me based on The Howling. And Alan Arkush did a great underseen movie called Get Crazy, musical with Malcolm McDowell. Not available on legitimate home video, unfortunately, but really, really great. Malcolm McDowell was kind of like a Mick Jagger character. Great movie. So I got to work with Alan again and with Kent Beta, who had been, was one of our co-editors, and he had been my assistant on Humanoids and The Howling, or actually my associate editor on The Howling. So, you know, working with the same people over and over again, having a great time. Then I worked on a movie called Wavelength, which was written and directed by Mike Gray. Mike had written The China Syndrome, which was a huge cautionary hit. He's one of the founders of Chicago Newsreel, agitprop, filmmaking, political. They shot about what was going on in Chicago during the Democratic Convention. Great stuff. A little scene film with Bobby Carradine and Sherry Curry. But I understand there's a Blu-ray edition going to come out eventually, or within a year or whatever.
Yeah, I looked it up actually. It is available. I know that a disc is coming out. There was something put on there. It is. I think there's a copy of it floating around on YouTube.
That's possible. Nice little movie. Really. Mm-hmm. Very low budget, but I was happy to work on it. Then Over the Brooklyn Bridge, which was Menachem, who apparently he had an editor on it, and this is what I was told happened. He was driving, his assistant told me this. They were in New York, because that's where they were shooting. He didn't like the way the editing was coming together. He said to his assistant, "Get me Mark Goldblatt. He saved my ninja." So, by the way, I hesitated to say when I did Enter the Ninja that I did have a co-editor. We split the film down the middle, and his name is Michael Duffy, and he's a very fine editor and should get credit where credit is due. So Michael Duffy co-edited Enter the Ninja with me, or I co-edited with him, if you want to put it either way. So going back to Over the Brooklyn Bridge, we got that picture working too. That one, Menachem had a distribution deal with MGM. So instead of releasing straight through Canon, a whole package of Canon films went through MGM, which meant better theaters, more distribution. So out of that, I got The Ambassador, but between that, I was very privileged to be asked to be the Terminator. And that's because Gail Hurd sold me to Jim Cameron. I only knew Jim to look at, basically, to nod at. We had worked in the same building at New World Pictures on Main Street in Venice, California. Jim had been prepping a number of pictures. He was an art director on Battle Beyond the Stars. He built sets. He became known as somebody who could pretty much solve any problem. And he and Gail had worked with him, and she had become a producer of record on The Terminator, put the deals together. And Jim had written it, and she was watching his back. And she had been very much aware of what we went through on New Noise from the Deep when she was working as Roger's assistant. So she recommended me to him. We had lunch. We realized we liked the same movies. In fact, The Road Warrior was the movie that both of us went crazy for that year. And he wanted to do something that would be of that intensity with the Terminator. The script was brilliant, by the way. You could see the movie crystally clear in that screenplay. Very, very complex and a low budget, although more money than any of us had ever seen on a picture prior to that. The budget was $6.4 million, or $6.8 million, depending on who you talk to. Anyway, it worked out great. You know, I would just cut this footage, work with Jim on Saturdays. He liked what he saw. I was loving what was coming together, and I loved what he did. Picture went out and was a huge hit. And Bob's your uncle, as they say.
So it was obviously the Terminator blew it up essentially, which would then, you know, I mean, honestly, it then leads into, as I said in my intro, just, I mean, a historic run of action films with some of the most visually dynamic directors that have made movies in my lifetime. I mean, it's just, it's totally insane. I mean, I still cannot believe that you seemingly cut Rambo, First Blood Part 2, and Commando back-to-back or overlapping.
Well, they were both pretty tight schedules. There was some time off in between, but not a lot. Because I remember exactly what happened on Rambo. Well, Rambo, I was on vacation, having just gotten off of the Ambassador, I guess. Is that possible? Yes, it is possible. And wait a second, didn't I do the... I did the Ambassador before the Terminator, though, even though it's listed the other way around. I did the Ambassador before the Terminator because of Arnold getting preempted. So the Terminator is what led to Rambo. And I was in Florida visiting with my wife and son to our in-laws, and I got a call from one of the producers, Andy Vanya, and they wanted me to take the movie over. Basically, they had an editor, but he was having some issues, going through a divorce, was distracted with whatever the issue was. So they wanted me. I guess Jim had recommended me, Jim Cameron. Jim had written one of the early drafts of Rambo.
Yep.
They said, come down to Mexico. They even said, well, how much do you want for the job? And I didn't even know how to do it. I didn't have an agent. So I think I took myself out of some money. It's like Andy was kind of saying, well, we want you to work weekends. So figure that in, you know. So, you know, if you have to work them, that is. But it didn't matter. I still got a raise compared to everything else. And I got the opportunity work on this amazing movie with George Cosmatos, who's a real visionary director, who became, I'm happy to say, we became very good friends. And really liked George. I miss him. He passed away some years back. But he was a great, crazy guy, but in a great way. He was a film buff. He was a fan of Humanoids from the Deep, if you can believe it. But it's true.
Yeah, definitely had some great credits.
Yeah, so anyway, we did that movie. That movie did incredible business. And, you know, we did it pretty quickly. I had to bring on a bunch of editors whom I supervised, but I cut a lion's share of it as well. And then I got a call from the great Joel Silver, legendary producer, who was doing Commando. And I guess he has liked my work on Rambo. And could I come and do Commando? And it was the same kind of situation where they were panicking about their editors. Whatever. So they wanted whatever kind of magic they perceived that I was adding or helping to create on these other movies. And that's what happened there. So that worked out really well. And from Commando, I got some buzz going because I was wanting to direct a picture. Mm. And Joel said he would produce the picture for me. Well, that never came about, but his implication that he would do that was enough to get things rolling. So then I did worked on another picture at Fox, Jumpin' Jack Flash, and then I basically stopped editing. I did do some additional work on Interspace. I stopped editing because I really wanted to pursue the directing career and figured I wouldn't be taken seriously as a director if I was still editing. People kept offering me editing jobs. And then, well, then we'll see, they would say. So I got second unit on RoboCop, second unit directing, because John Davison, my old pal, and a great producer, was producing this movie RoboCop. And Paul Verhoeven was the director.
He produced a bunch of Paul Verhoeven's films, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, he did. Starship Troopers being the other part of the bunch.
Yep.
Anyway, he introduced me to Paul earlier. And I had met Paul and had lunch with him. Pretty great. I mean, what happened was I was screening a movie at Fox. Because when I wasn't editing there back in those days, they would let me run movies in the theaters. You know, you could call up just about any film from the archives or any other studio's archives. And one of the films I had wanted to see was Ridley Scott's European cut of the Tom Cruise picture, Legend. You know Legend?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so with the... the European edit had a score by Jerry Goldsmith, and it was also longer. It was a longer cut of the picture, Ridley's cut. I was especially interested in. I knew Jerry Goldsmith, obviously, having done Rambo, and I wanted to see his score in the movie, and also I wanted to see the movie. I had never seen it. Fox had the foreign rights to it, so I got to screen this version. I invited John Davison to see it. John said, do you mind if I bring Paul Verhoeven along? I guess they were interested in or had already booked Poteen to work on RoboCop. But anyway, Paul showed up, but John bowed out. John couldn't come that day. So it was just Paul Verhoeven and me watching Legend, and you know, Paul wanted to see it for Jerry's music and for Rob's work as well. And Rob did some of his best work on Legend. So anyway, we kind of bonded. And I remember I took him to lunch in the commissary, and I introduced him to the head of production on the lot. Nobody knew who he was. So this is Paul Verhoeven before most people knew who Paul Verhoeven was, unless you knew his Dutch films, or you'd done one film in English, you wouldn't know who he was. And obviously he was about to go make RoboCop, and then everybody knew who he was. So pretty great. So that's how I met Paul, and then when they were looking for someone to come in and shoot some additional footage, because they were on a very tight schedule, like RoboCop, of course, was an indie low-budget movie. And they would have to shoot out certain locations and sets, and then move the principal unit to the next location. It was all choreographed in terms of budget, which meant that if there was a key scene with RoboCop, and RoboCop, they didn't shoot out yet, I would come in and finish the scene. So the night I got there, I stayed up, and there were shooting nights, and I watched Paul direct the scene in which RoboCop is menaced by the police guys who were after him. They trap him in a parking structure and shoot him up, basically. They just pump bullets into him. And then they had to wrap that scene by the time dawn happened. And I then went and discussed with Paul what was missing in terms of his intentions, what he wanted to get. more shots of RoboCop, RoboCop falling on his knee, RoboCop rolling around, rolling from one level to the next level, so that I would shoot it the next night. And I believed in storyboards, so I managed to get a storyboard artist to work with me. And basically I got Paul to approve these boards, and he said, just get that stuff, and then you can shoot whatever you want in the scene. And that's what I did. So I worked shooting second unit for a bunch of weeks until I was forced to go back to L.A. because I had meetings pending on some of these movies that I was attached to for directing. So I had to kind of deal with that as well. So at least I was in demand for some stuff and trying to push my my directing career forward, which ultimately did happen. After Jumpin' Jack Flash, that was my last editing job. And as I said, I did the RoboCop work. And then I got Dead Heat. At least it went into an agreed concept of trying to make the film. So it didn't really have a green light. It had an amber light. Then Dead Heat was sold. New World was sold to a new regime. So I had to convince a new set of executives to keep Dead Heat on their dockets for filming. But they did. So eventually we got to make it. And it was a great experience for me. Picture didn't do very well, unfortunately. But that's what happens sometimes. But I did have a deal to do a second picture. So I did The Punisher, which we shot in Australia. I really enjoyed directing, and I think I made mistakes on both pictures in various ways, but I like them, and they're mine.
Clearly, The Punisher has a specific. Not that Dead Heat doesn't, but The Punisher has certainly attained a cult following throughout the years. And like I said in the intro, it's a movie that I had a chance to watch a ton on video when I was growing up.
Well, yeah. Apparently, a lot of people saw it for the first time on video.
Well, it didn't get an American theatrical release, if I'm not mistaken, correct?
That's correct. And finally, there was a U.S. premiere at a comics convention here in L.A. I think they showed my print. But no, it didn't get a. Well, what happened was New World got sold yet again, even between the making of The Punisher and its release, and they sold off every film. Because they were out of the distribution business, they were out of the film business.
And was it a production reason through the company? Like, I know that I'm asking a question I think that a lot of people are interested to know. What was the reason why the costume did not have the skull on it?
Well, the simple reason for that.
People say it was like a licensing thing, and I don't know.
It wasn't a licensing thing. It was a bad decision. We wanted to stay away from the latex suit idea. If you think about some of the superheroes that, like Spider-Man TV show, we didn't want a form-fitting costume. So we came up with Norma Morrisseau, our very gifted director. I'm sorry, art director, I was going to say, but she really was the production designer. She had come out of costume design and had done the Mad Max costume for George Miller and Crocodile Dundee costume. So we set her the task of making a costume. And she came up with this great leather costume that was very thick leather, kind of protect the Punisher when he's getting beaten or thrown around. We just wanted to stay away from the obvious, and we thought that the logo was too obvious. And that was a big mistake, because people missed it. And we could have done it in a naturalistic way. We could have had it like a stenciled on homemade T-shirt that he made that went in with his costume. And his costume was a costume. He lived in his costume. He didn't change into it. He slept in it. He's kind of like a bohemian. Lives in the sewers. Skulks around. Anyway, it was too late after we made the movie to add a logo. Unless we did it digitally. I guess we could do it today, but there's really no point. So I'll cop to taking the responsibility for that, although we all agreed on it. But it was
an idea.
But you know what we did do? We did have a knife with a skull on it.
Yeah, nice.
And that's what was, that was supposed to take the place, a subtler kind of logo.
I love your version of the Punisher. It's my favorite one that's been theatrically done.
The new one on TV is really good.
I haven't caught up that far on Daredevil yet, but I have a lot of people telling me I need to catch up and see the Punisher in the second season. I'm a big fan of the Thomas Jane, John Travolta one. I like that one.
Thomas Jane is a terrific actor.
Yes, he is.
I like all of the Punisher movies.
I do too. I mean, the Punisher's always been one of my favorite characters. I have a couple of questions for you pertaining to the film. I guess the one that I really want to know is, I don't know if you have seen the Kill Bill films by Quentin Tarantino.
Yes, I have.
Now, I don't know if you know where I'm going with this, but
the ninja fights.
Not the ninja fights, but more so the Lucy Liu's character in...
Oh, Lady Tanaka.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Never thought about that connection.
I think that the scene with Lady Tanaka and Jerome Krebby, I think that's how you say his last name?
Krebby.
That was close.
Right. Am I making too much noise as I'm chewing on my protein?
No, you're perfect.
Good.
I feel like the scene with the two of them together around the table, Quentin Tarantino heavily homaged that scene with Lucy Liu and her at the head of the table.
I never thought of that.
Really?
Now, here's an antecedent for you. I know for a fact that Quentin was influenced by the Lady Snowblood movies. You know these movies?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, I've only seen the first Lady Snowblood movie. I guess you could say I was influenced by it too. But,
yeah.
But I don't remember anything quite like that Failure on Crabbe scene. And you're right. The Lucy Liu character is like that. I never thought of that. Now, I've met Quentin several times, and one time he told me that he had been a big fan of The Punisher when it first came out on tape. He watched it numerous times. So
there you go.
Because he's the kind of guy who absorbs everything he sees.
Yeah, I mean, plus at the time of that film coming out, I believe is the same time frame of when he was working at the video store in L.A. and he was watching everything, so... I bet you that's what happened.
You know, I never made that connection though. Thank you for enlightening me.
Yeah, no problem. I really picked up on that when I revisited The Punisher on DVD a few years after I saw Kill Bill a bunch of times because I'm a big Quentin Tarantino fan, and I was sitting here watching it and I was just thinking to myself, I was like, wow.
Mm.
Like he homaged the Dolph Lundgren Punisher film. Like, that's amazing. My second question is, I'm a huge Dolph Lundgren fan. I mean, I'm as highbrow of a cinephile as someone can get with my movie collection, but I know Nick's heard me say this a million times. I think I own almost all the Dolph Lundgren stuff that's come out on Blu-ray.
Wow.
And And DVD, well, not all of it, but quite probably the stuff that's come out in the most recent years that he's directed.
Right.
How did you end up casting him as the Punisher?
That's a good question. I remember when we went to meet him, he was in a short list of people that the studio would make a movie with. I was fascinated. We went to see him in his house in Malibu. And I had seen him in Rocky IV.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Red Scorpion. But I didn't realize, in real life, he's like a regular guy. His accent was not particularly noticeable. He was laid back. You know, he usually plays these big, serious, hulky kind of characters.
Mm-hmm.
He was funny. And I thought, wow, that's a side of him I've never seen on the screen. What if we can get that, especially in the Frank Castle performance? What if we can mine all that cool being there stuff? I mean, it's the existential Dolph. So, I mean, he was very excited about it, by the way. He had already been reading Punisher comics and had some Punisher limited edition posters. He was very up for doing the role. So I went with Robert Kamen, our producer, and with our casting director. He seemed like a really natural fit for the part. And and as I say, he was very anxious to do it. Now, the other thing I didn't know, which I had learned after we met him, was that he was a world-class kickboxer. I mean, he was in competition. He had won many awards. And when we finally went over to Australia to make the picture, I learned that he had lived in Australia for a long time when he was in college. He actually, I believe, studied engineering. He's a very smart guy.
Yeah, he's a chemical engineer.
Yeah. And but at the same time that he was doing that, he was working as a bouncer in clubs. And he was pursuing his kickboxing. So, jack of all trades, really. So he was very excited about the karate. And Robert Kamen, our producer, you know, was the guy who originally created The Karate Kid and wrote the screenplays for those movies, and is a karate guy himself. So Robert Kamen became very involved, in checking in on Dahl's training, because we wanted everything to be authentic. Kamen flew to Tokyo to find two really professional karate guys. They didn't speak English either. To play the two assassins in the movie. And he went to a lot of dojos looking. So came up with some real winners too. But they're really good. I mean, the fight scenes. I like the fight scenes a lot.
Yeah, it's a nasty. It's a brutal movie. I mean, it's one of the few R-rated, you know, superhero comic book movies out there. I mean, it had a real attitude.
Mm-hmm. It's very dark. I think its darkness is probably. I mean, the Punisher is a dark character to begin with.
Yeah.
I
mean, he's like a corpse. I mean, my point of view was that Frank Castle died. But became reanimated, and the Punisher is almost like a zombie, not in the metaphysical spiritual sense, but in the shell of a person sense. He's just a different guy. He's resurrected. He's an angel of death. That's not very romantic. I guess,
no.
You know.
No, but it's very interesting.
It's interesting, but not romantic. Not traditionally sexy either.
Right.
You know, in a lot of movies, the protagonists, they show off their biceps. And I know in Dahiti, even Joe Piscopo would put oil his biceps on. You know, they used to use mink oil on some of these movies. It makes it look like you're sweating on your body. But it
must have been stuff that Stallone and Schwarzenegger used on Rambo and Commando, respectively. There's a couple of insert shots that I'm assuming it was you or one of the editors edited in on Commando of Schwarzenegger unloading that machine gun.
Yeah, that's similar. Yeah, I actually shot that. I didn't shoot it. I directed all that stuff, all the tight stuff, the machine guns. Watch.
That's the most epic stuff.
It's some weird stuff.
It's amazing.
You know when he's chained to the table? When they have him captive and he's chained to the table and says, "I'm going to get you," something like that. We're talking about Schwarzenegger now in Commando.
Yep.
So I was directing Arnold. It was actually Arnold's arms, and because we got full body shots. And Arnold, come on! You want to get him? You're going to kill him! You're going to kill him! You know, and he was reacting. So I mean, I got to direct Arnold even for a micro minute. But it was good. It's fun stuff. But those shots were very helpful in the movie. It became kind of iconic.
Absolutely. And you jump back in, and you jump back into editing after The Punisher.
Mm-hmm. Well, The Punisher, as you said, didn't get a theatrical release.
Yeah, I mean,
that really hurt my career. I was offered some other stuff. And I believe most of the stuff I was offered never got made, but I didn't accept. Because I didn't want to do a lower level of action picture. I wanted something that had some reason to exist other than just a lot of explosions. So, my agent at the time got in touch with me and said, would you consider going in and doing a fix-up job on some editing? And the movie in question was Nightbreed, directed by Clive Barker.
Yeah.
The story is, there were issues with the movie. Studio wasn't happy. Could I help them make a movie that they were happier with? Now, I met with the producer. She explained the situation. Now, Clive Barker is a very formidable guy. You know, this movie, Nightbreed, was based on his novel, Cabal. He directed the movie. He directed Hellraiser. Before that, Hellraiser was a very successful movie. Very good movie. So what's the problem? Well, they wanted the movie paced up. I mean, the studio actually communicated a set of notes, I guess, because I didn't get any set of notes from them at all. I mean, I could see that there were ways to make the movie more exciting. And there were ways to compress some of the narrative so that you got to things quicker. Clive had an agreement with the studio to address their notes. So we worked very closely together because I didn't want to do anything that was against what Clive was willing to do. I mean, he deserves the respect. and we were working together. So we came up with a tighter, meaner version of the movie, which also necessitated taking some of the exposition out. I mean, Clive wasn't happy with it, but he signed off on it. So, meaning not happy because he had to sacrifice certain things. And that's why there's a current director's cut.
Right. I haven't seen that yet. I missed out when Scream Factory released that big three-disc set. I love Nightbreed. I have that old Snapcase DVD. I need to track down that set. I don't think they're selling it anymore, but I really need to see that version of the film, because that's a strange film, and I love it. I mean, I've watched it probably at least 10 times, and I'm very curious to see that his authorized cut. I mean, I don't want to spoil it too hard, but I mean, David Cronenberg has a role in the film, which I think in a way says it all.
Well, David Cronenberg has a substantial role in the film.
Yes.
Both versions. He's got some additional scenes in the new version. But it's gratifying to me that a great deal of what I did have made it into the director's cut. Most of the changes that I noticed were putting other things back in that we had taken out. Especially stuff with the priest's character.
Mm-hmm.
And a little bit of Cronenberg. A little bit of the exposition for the lead character.
I'm actually checking. Oh, they still have the Blu-ray for the director's cut on their website. I'm going to have to order this.
How much do they want for it?
It is $23.95.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
The director's cut.
This version, because the three-disc version.
The three-disc version was kind of pricey, and I think that was numbered.
Yeah, but it comes with the R-rated. I mean, I don't know what rating the director's cut is, but it comes with the standard release version, is what the three-disc one of the discs. Which you don't really need anymore, because that's already been available, hasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Although the Blu-ray is much better. The Blu-ray is better because it looks better. So that's the reason
you get it. You sound like a big disc collector, Mark.
You're not?
No, it sounds like you are.
Oh, me? Yes, I have tons of discs.
Yeah, so are we.
So are we. We're addicted. I'm completely addicted. We're swimming in them. That's good.
Thousands and thousands. I can't even tell you. And no one can keep them in. And my system of cataloging is terrible. So a lot of stuff I can't find. I need an
open. It's tough for me, but as I try and keep it alphabetized down to like AA, AB, AC, AD. It gets pretty intense with my shelving.
Things,
with having to rearrange everything whenever I get something new. Yeah, it's bad.
Well, so it goes. Yeah, I think what I was trying to say is one of the other things that got trimmed down a bit was a bit of Boone's story and his relationship with Cronenberg's character, his psychiatrist. I think there were a couple of extra cuts in there that don't bother me so much. It could go back in. They certainly went back in the director's cut. So I think those are probably some good things that went back in, just at the beginning of the picture, just to set up Boone a little better. That's the one area that I think maybe gets rushed into a little bit in the release version. Introducing Laurie, introducing Boone and Laurie's relationship and Cronenberg's manipulation as a shrink. Okay.
Yeah, when we took our break, I just ordered the Shout Factory director's cut. So I'm very much looking forward to seeing
this. I guess
this.
I'm influencing you and spending hard-earned money.
It's not really that hard. Usually if Nick and I spend more than 5-10 minutes talking about a film that we haven't seen or we're browbeating the other one into seeing, Amazon.com gets our money pretty quick.
Yeah, I hear you.
I'm dying to ask you about The Predator 2.
Okay.
Because the first Predator film is about as iconic as it gets when it comes to 80s action films and the action genre in general. And I love the series. Sans for Alien vs. Predator, those two movies I'm not a huge fan of, but I like the Predators movie that came out however many years ago, not too long ago. But Predator 2 I've always enjoyed thoroughly because it's a direct pivot from the original film in a very kind of neo-noir way.
Yes. I'm a big fan of Predator 2. I really like it. I'm very proud of the work I did on it, too. There's a lot of good work in it from many, many different people. If it has one problem, which goes to the reality that the picture was not a huge financial success at the box office. The problem with the film is that it goes against expectation as a sequel. And why is that? Because Arnold Schwarzenegger doesn't return to the sequel.
Mm-hmm.
And that's unfortunate. Which is not to say that Danny Glover isn't terrific in the movie. He certainly is. If you were making this as a first movie in a Predator saga, you would be watching it under a different set of circumstances. But because it's a sequel, and because Arnold is such a huge presence, you kind of miss him. I miss him. But more to the fact, the audience that didn't show up to pay money to see the movie certainly missed him because they didn't show up.
Yeah.
You know, it's like somebody made a movie once called Smokey is the Bandit. It was the very last of the Smokey and the Bandit movies. And Burt Reynolds was not in the movie. He'd been in all the other sequels. In this one, they changed the plot so that Jackie Gleason played the bandit and the cop.
I've never seen that.
Well, it's like you can't do that. Nothing against Jackie Gleason. He's terrific. But in both cases, I'm sure that the producers had prepared a movie that was meant to star Burt Reynolds in the case of the Smokey and the Bandit movie, and in this movie, Arnold. And I can tell you for a fact that the studio was trying to convince him to do the movie, but he opted not to do it. Because, you know, Arnold was very big by this point.
Yeah.
I mean, he had a lot of people after him to do movies. I'm sure there was something on his plate that was competing with this particular picture. I can tell you, I got a phone call from Arnold's agent in which he was talking to me about this movie. He said, they really want Arnold to do the movie. Are you really going to cut the movie? Because remember, I have stopped editing, right?
Yeah.
But I had committed to doing the movie. And the reason, at that point, I don't even think they had decided which way the cast was going to go. First of all, it was a Joel Silver production, so Joel knew me and wanted me to do it. Second of all, it was directed by Stephen Hopkins, whom I knew, whom I liked very much. Stephen Hopkins, I had met Steve Hopkins to Russell Mulcahy, the director of Highlander and a lot of other good movies. And I was always trying to find a way. I mean, Russell wanted me to work with him on some stuff, and we were always looking for something to do together. And I met Steve probably through Russell and through my friend Keith Williams. Keith used to work with Russell Mulcahy. They devised some of the great classic rock videos of the 80s. Elton John stuff, I mean, all kinds of stuff. And Steve Hopkins used to do videos and direct a second unit on Highlander. And he's a great guy, and he really wanted me to do it. So all these people wanted me to do it. I had just come off of Clive Barker's movie. I was not getting editing offers of the quality that I was interested in. And then this was like a major studio picture, a sequel to a movie that I liked. And I thought there was a chance that Arnold might do it. So, but Arnold ultimately declined. And so the idea was, let's float the picture, let's try to make the picture based on an ensemble performance thing, in which they would get really good actors. I mean, I don't know how that differs from any other movie, but these are all notable actors. Ruben Blade, Gary Busey, Danny Glover, of course, Maria Conchita Alonso, Bill Paxton, Robert Davi. Good, solid cast.
Yeah, it's an excellent cast.
So that's the way it went. Some rewrites occurred, obviously, or maybe they had done this version as a backup. The idea being we'll sell it on the monster and a bunch of good actors. But I guarantee you, if Arnold had been in it, this picture would have opened big, and it didn't open big. But, you don't know. Nobody ever knows, really, what's going to really pay off and be successful and what's not.
What did you think about when you saw the footage that they had shot of the trophy case, which has become a very big scene for fans of both the Alien and Predator franchises?
It's very wonderful self-referential stuff.
Before people were all fixated on being self-referential and, world building and crossing over and stuff.
Yes. Absolutely.
Do you know if that was something that was in the original script or something that was thought up of during production? Or
tell you. I cannot tell you.
You don't know. Okay.
But it was funny. It was a fun moment.
Yeah, it is a fun moment, and Predator, the first Predator has this great mix of science fiction and action, the jungle setting, and then the second one, it's darker, it's almost meaner, it's nastier, you have the whole, gang war and the rotting Los Angeles backdrop.
Well, that's the
whole voodoo thing, yeah.
The movie is exceedingly violent.
Very violent.
And when we previewed it, unfortunately, it was too late to change the movie. Or I guess it was the premiere. I was out in the lobby pacing around, and I ran into one of the producers. He says, "Mark, I think we went too far." He said, and he named a well-known Hollywood agent. He says, "So-and-so's wife just threw up." So, it's like, it's one thing when people throw up, it's another thing if it's the wife of a well-known agent, because I guess it gets around. But, it was the time of the R-rated action-adventure movie. And even for an R, we did go the limit.
Yeah,
nobody
you definitely
seem more.
You
No one said anything to you guys. There was never a thought during production or when you guys were putting it together that it was too violent. It was only after the fact, like when cumulatively, when the.
It was only after the fact. It's amazing.
Interesting. Yeah, because, I mean, you're a majority of your credits.
I'll tell you what it was. A bunch, you know, we were all comic fans and horror movie fans. And, you know, that's why today you preview everything. That's why, unfortunately, I mean, the other side of the coin is that people are making a lot of PG-13 movies these days. And which really declined. I mean, imagine this movie, Predator 2, with a PG-13. Cutting away from everything.
Yeah.
And
absolutely. I mean, your credits are such, I mean, they hit on so many of the great full-blown R-rated action movies, the stuff that Hollywood seemingly doesn't care to make anymore and audiences don't want to see anymore for some reason, for the most part. I mean, I am at a loss for words with how sorry the state of action filmmaking is right now, in my opinion. I just, with rare exceptions and most of them coming from overseas, like The Raid or The Raid 2 even, you know, even more so than The Raid, the PG-13ing of the modern action film is a joke. And, you know, it's further amplified when you look at stuff like, you know, Commando and Rambo and, you know, something like Tony Scott's The Last Boy Scout. I mean, you know, Frank and I are huge Tony Scott fans. I'm one of the world's biggest Tony Scott fans. And you know, to say nothing of his other films, The Last Boy Scout is one of the most iconic violent movies ever made.
Pretty violent. We'll get into that next week.
Yeah.
But, yeah, you know, it's unfortunate. But,
you know, I
really think if Arnold had been in it, it wouldn't have mattered. You know, you think about it, True Lies is R-rated.
Mm. I just watched it earlier the week. They just don't make movies like that anymore, and I don't know why. Like, it's just, that's the way you make an action-adventure movie. I mean, it's just, True Lies is, for me, it's my favorite James Cameron movie. I mean, Terminator 2, that movie I saw when I was 11, another film that you worked on. I saw that in the theater, and that was a mind-blowing experience. There's a sense of fun to True Lies that's missing in a lot of the big-budget action movies these days, and my God, you guys got away with some amazing stuff there.
Well, you know, you're working with a genius writer-director. Makes a big difference. He's one in a million. His movies are all complex and entertaining at the same time. So that's Jim Cameron.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm sure.
I got Jim to agree to watch Predator 2 before we locked negative, you know? He liked it. He was a fan.
It's awesome to hear. Never, certainly not heard that before.
He must have liked the trophy at the end of the film.
What's that?
I said he had to have gotten a kick out of the trophy at the end of the film of the Xenomorph skull.
Definitely. Yeah, he liked it. I don't think he had any notes that I can remember.
No notes from Cameron, then you're all set.
But, you know, as I say, if Arnold had been in the picture, I'm sure people would have flocked to see it.
Oh, absolutely. But, I mean,
can you imagine a Rocky movie without Sylvester Stallone?
No.
You wouldn't do that.
No, I mean, even with Creed, it's still Rocky.
Yeah, he's still got to be there.
Exactly.
Redefined. His dramatic role is redefined. But that might have worked for a Predator sequel, too. See, the obvious, and I believe the original idea, was that Arnold was now out of the Army and was working in law enforcement in L.A., his character. And that's how he's involved. So it's just the same thing as Danny Glover's part of Harrigan, basically.
See, because I had read, and I didn't know if it was true, that Arnold Schwarzenegger was originally supposed to be Gary Busey's character.
Well, then it would have been a completely different picture.
Right.
No, I didn't read that version. It's possible. It's possible. He might have been working for the government. I don't know. But in any event, that's all water under the bridge. But
yes.
Let's look at the virtues of the movie. It's got some great performances. Some great set pieces. I love the raid on the drug house at the beginning of the picture, where Danny Glover's hanging out on the side of the car,
mm-hmm.
you know, shooting. There's a lot of great stuff in it. So, and I love Bill Paxton. Very funny.
Yes, he's fantastic in the film.
He's great. Yeah, I mean, it's just like you look at the genre pictures that guy has been a part of, and it's like unbelievable. And yeah, I mean, he had a clear blast in Predator too. I mean, I've always loved the movie. There's always been this strange appeal to me about Predator 2, and I've never been able to quite put my finger on it. Stephen Hopkins movies in general, I'm a fan of. I think that he always had a great visual style. You know, Ghost in the Darkness in particular, I've always been a big fan of. And he directed you know, Under Suspicion, which Frank and I love.
Yeah, Under Suspicion's fantastic.
And I just always felt that he was such a great eye. Obviously, what he did with 24, you know, reinventing, you know, action on TV. But Predator 2 always had this really grungy, nasty vibe, and I was always just, like, really entertained by it. And you know.
Well, it takes place in the near future in L.A. It's hot, it's sweaty, it's dirty, people are paranoid, everyone carries guns. It's just...
basically today.
It's a jungle. It's a modern jungle. So that's the metaphor. As opposed to the first picture, it's jungle to jungle. Predators like jungles. They're drawn to the area because there's so much repressed violence. Or not even repressed. That's how they live. That's how they roll. So, good stuff. And yes, Steve Hopkins does have a terrific visual style. He has a unique way of shooting. He kind of does cross versions of complicated camera movement master shots, where you can basically cut these things into pieces, and they kind of work and they intersect well with each other. So he gets a lot of coverage out of a minimal amount of setups. It's really good.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, in the next part of our chat, you know, we're going to get into some of the stuff with, you know, more stuff with Cameron, obviously Tony Scott, Michael Bay, and the Paul Verhoevens. And I guess one of the big things we'll be looking to find out about is, you know, what it was like to, you know, the differences for cutting, you know, for these different guys who have very different visual styles, and, you know, how they all approach, you know, action and their sense of, you know, of staging. Because going back and forth from all those different styles has got to be a unique thing for an editor. I mean, it's got to be a challenge.
Yeah, it is. It is. I mean, they're all different. They're all different people. They have different views of reality and of cinema to a degree. So, but on top of all of that, storytelling still remains the principal point here. Good storytelling. So that's the one thing I try to impose on whatever I'm working on. Clear, concise storytelling.
Well, thank you so much for your time, and we look forward to chatting with you again for our second volume with you, where we can get into everything post-Predator 2 to present day. And that's going to be a ton of fun.
Okay, guys, thanks so much.